You're listening to Stealing from Wizards, Volume 2, Burglary, by R.A. Consul. Chapter 21, The Greatest of All Treasures. The trip across the bay felt incredibly long. Kuro had gifts to give and friendships to mend, but he couldn't do that in the Blandlands. First, Charlie had explained to him that there were strict rules about Solstice gifts and not being allowed to open them until Solstice Day. He wasn't about to make his friends get in trouble for breaking rules when he meant to be doing something nice. Also, Marie's gift had to wait until the far shore or she wouldn't be able to get it out of the Vale. The method he knew for getting gold out to the Blandlands worked only once. If it weren't for his magic bag, the whole plan would have fallen apart before he started. He could keep the package in his bag for the trip across the bay. Then, once they were back in the Fey Realm on the far shore, he could take it out and give it to her. And then she could take it to the Blandlands. The passing through the Vale, though, would strip away the protective layers that he put around it, so it was a one-way trip. Charlie filled the time on the boat by talking about all the things she and Kuro would do on her farm over the break. This did not particularly ease tensions. While Marie wouldn't say it, even if she could have gotten a word in, she was jealous of Kuro for going to the farm while she was going to the boring Blandlands. Moira insisted on joining her brother for the journey home, as Azalea, the only other person who could tolerate her, was staying behind. Fortunately, Moira was too well raised to interrupt Charlie with accusations of Kuro's criminal nature, so she instead spent the journey trying to drill a hole in Kuro's head with her eyes. Kuro was glad magic didn't work in the Blandlands, or she might have succeeded. At long last, they plunged through the Vale out of the horrible cold of the Blandlands Bay and into the horrible cold of the Fey Realm. Kuro had skipped winter entirely the year before by staying on Avalon, where the seasons were stationary. He'd only been to the port at the beginning and end of the school year and had sort of imagined it to be permanently pleasant. It was not. The dock was full of impatient parents fighting against the cold with a combination of mittens and magic. The hustle of disembarkation created a great opportunity to slip presents into the luggage of his companions. He didn't know if it was necessary. He hadn't been told about his gifts the previous year, so he had to assume they were meant to be kept secret. Also, by sneaking them, he avoided having to deal directly with the strained moods of Arthur and Marie. There was a good possibility that they would have thanked him and been full of smiles. But then there was a chance they wouldn't. Kuro was exhausted from trying to get everything together in time and didn't have the nerves left to face that. A quick drop into a coat pocket as Charlie was jostled by a first-year student, desperate to reach their family. An imperceptible tug on a backpack zipper as Marie fought to stay balanced on the ramp. And a simple sleight of hand as Arthur scanned the crowd for his parents, and Kuro's gifts were delivered. He was pleased with himself. His skills at pickpocketing hadn't diminished too much in his pampered life full of regular meals and warm beds. He was rescued from any chance of being found out by Charlie's impatience. She grabbed Kuro's hand and hauled him towards her waiting father. He was the easiest person to find in the parking lot. Among gilded sleds, enchanted sedans, and royal carriages, his rusting red pickup truck stood out clearly. Her father was a broad man, who wore denims and plaids like armor and had the kind of facial hair that took a dedicated lack of maintenance to achieve. Charlie flung herself at him with reckless abandon, and, to his credit, he was only knocked back a couple of steps by the enthusiastic hug. Once he had managed to adequately greet his daughter and detangle himself from her, he turned to Kuro. "You're staying with us this year, eh?"
"Yes, sir,"
said Kuro, staring fixedly at the ground.
"Well, you're gonna have to work for it," he grumbled. "No idle hands on the farm."
"Of course, sir."
Charlie came to his rescue.
"Gosh, Dad, stop it! Kuro doesn't know how jokes work."
That wasn't true, Kuro thought. It was Arthur who didn't understand jokes. Kuro just forgot he was allowed to laugh out loud sometimes. It wasn't clear what the joke was supposed to be, though. It was quite reasonable to have to work for his room and board, and most of the things Charlie had talked about doing sounded a lot like work. Regardless, her dad boomed with laughter and clapped Kuro on the shoulder.
"I'm just kidding. You're more than welcome to lounge around while Charlie does all the work."
There was a glint of a grin through the thick growth of beard as he spoke.
"That's my plan, anyway."
"Thank you, sir,"
said Kuro.
while Charlie's dad fended off the assault his comment had earned from his daughter. "And please, call me Jack." That request was a bit too much for Kuro. In his experience, adults didn't have first names. They had titles. Mr., Miss., Ms., Professor., Knight Commander., Master. He couldn't imagine actually calling this man Jack. They piled into the truck, all three across one bench seat, with Kuro jammed in the middle because he was the smallest. They didn't explain why being the smallest meant that he was also obligated to be the least comfortable, but who was he to argue? Kuro watched the scenery fly by as Charlie described a version of their school year to her father that Kuro could barely recognize. Her recounting was full of adventure, villainy, mystery, romance, and drama that bore little resemblance to the classes and homework that Kuro remembered. They took Zephyr Way, a ferry road that stretched across the whole of the realm and marked the border between Alfheim and Tirnanog. With snow covering most of the land and the warping of space around the road, almost all sense of distance was lost. The world was just an endless expanse of white. It was impossible to tell if the few hills and trees were great mountains and vast forests, or stumpy mounds and lonely thickets. After a couple of hours, a lonely sign in an otherwise empty expanse told them that they were leaving the kingdoms and entering the wildlands. It was a simple sign and poorly maintained, just a splash of paint on bare wood. It stood less as an indication of a border crossing and more as a warning. Past that point, they were in the lawless lands of monsters. Giants roamed the mountains, and werewolves hunted the forests. Or so it was said. Kuro couldn't see any difference from the previous hour of travel. Soon the western mountains appeared over the horizon as if it were baring its teeth. The nearly impossibly straight and level road started to climb through rolling foothills, and the sparse trees became thicker and began to hug the road. Without warning, Mr. Cook slowed the truck and turned into a driveway Kuro hadn't even seen until they were on it. A small hand-carved sign proclaimed it to be the Cook Farm and was nailed to a post and half-covered in snow. Having never spent time on a farm, Kuro couldn't judge this one. It seemed large, with several fenced-off fields, a pair of red barns, and a good-sized house, all with lines of trees to break the wind. It seemed pretty empty, though, with a single graying, sway-backed unicorn lazily wandering around on top of the snow. Otherwise, the fields were bleak and bare. A few scattered sheds added to the effect. Upon crossing the threshold of the house, Kuro was attacked. A barking mass of shaggy fur slammed into him, knocking him flat. He scrambled to escape the drooling, toothy maw as Charlie leaped to his defense.
"Ralph, no! Down! Sit!" she said sternly.
The beast whined in complaint, but obediently retreated enough to allow Kuro to stand. Ralph then sat, panting and drooling, his tongue hanging out the side of his mouth as if he were waiting for permission to finish the meal he'd just been denied.
"Sorry," said Charlie as she helped Kuro to his feet. "He's a good dog, but he gets really excited to meet new people. Come on, I'll give you the tour."
Charlie led him through the house, and Ralph followed, waiting for his chance to strike when his mistress wasn't attending. The house was much like Mr. Cook, rough and sturdy, but welcoming. No effort had been wasted decorating, and everything had a clear purpose. Most of the furniture was made of unvarnished wood and carried the mark of the tools that crafted it. The Spartan style made the few embellishments stand out. A round, ornately painted shield hanging on the wall in the living room. A silver horseshoe above each exit. A spear displayed prominently on the mantel above the fireplace. All were mementos of Charlie's mother, Helena, who had been an enchantress and a warrior in Alfheim before she had been kidnapped to raise Kuro. Charlie's bedroom was the exception to the uncluttered and practical house. It was littered with pictures she'd drawn, interesting rocks, leaves and animal skulls she'd collected, and a collection of books to rival Danny's, all of it on a backdrop of yellow so bright it strained the eyes. It wasn't just the paint was brightly colored, it was bright enough to light the room. Her walls were enchanted to glow at a level to rival daylight. Kuro was quickly pulled out of the house to tour the barns, which is where all the good stuff was, according to Charlie. By her definition, the good stuff was large and dangerous animals. Most of the stalls were occupied by creatures that looked as though someone had glued spare parts to lions, manticores, chimeras, griffins, and a whole litter of baby cryosphinxes, which were winged lions with goat heads. Charlie was most excited about them, as her father had given her the important task of naming them. Charlie had a way with animals. Monsters 10 times her size would roll over and let her scratch their necks.
Perhaps it was because she had raised many of them from birth, and they knew and trusted her to feed them. Kuro, on the other hand, was frequently identified as something that she had brought to feed them with. The creatures pawed the ground, drooled, and sniffed at Kuro, waiting for permission from their keeper to dine on the tasty morsel that had followed her into their paddocks. Even the cryosphinxes, who had never met Charlie, warmed to her right away, nuzzling her and bleating for milk and comfort, while their siblings practiced ramming Kuro. They weren't big enough to do much damage, but he still came away with a couple bruises from the charges he'd failed to dodge, while Charlie was deciding whether to call the smallest Leonard or Alphonse. Kuro much preferred the second barn. It was admittedly less impressive, but nothing there tried to make a meal of him. There were ordinary things like chickens, goats, and a couple of cows, which Kuro had only encountered in the cooked form, so to him they were just as fantastic as the 10-foot centipede. The magical creatures there were much milder as well. The old unicorn came in from the snow to greet Charlie and investigate the new unicorn on the farm, Charlie's ever-present familiar, Henrietta. A couple of jackalopes got their antlers tangled when they both tried to nibble the same piece of lettuce. Then there was George. George was a pixie house tortoise, so named because his shell had angular plates that looked like dormers and little awnings where his head and legs poked through. But he wasn't quite the right size for pixies. Tortoises like him never stopped growing, and he'd outlived three of his previous owners. He was the size of a small tent and moved nearly as fast. Kuro liked him immediately. Kuro had lived his life at the edge of disaster, one step away from starvation, capture, and failure. Everything had always been urgent and desperate, and the few times when it wasn't, he was constantly anxious, waiting for the next crisis. George had a very different outlook. There was no reason to hurry. The bit of lettuce he was eating, one lazy bite at a time, would still be waiting for him after a lengthy nap. Should a jackalope steal it? Another would appear if he slept long enough. In the time it took George to blink, Kuro could pick three pockets, steal a meal, and eat it. George seemed to have the level of confidence in his own future that Kuro had never thought of imagining. It was soothing just to be in his presence. Charlie didn't let Kuro bask in it for long, but that was okay. George would be there later, still eating the same salad. Days moved quickly on the farm. There was always something that needed doing. An animal to be fed, eggs to be collected, tools to be fixed. With Charlie home, her father set about doing repairs and maintenance that he hadn't had time for when he was alone, leaving the animal care to the children. For the first day, Kuro followed Charlie as a shadow, but he wasn't needed. Charlie could use her outstanding telekinesis to feed five beasts at a time while also filling a water trough, and the addition of Henrietta meant she could even haul the heaviest equipment around. While Charlie insisted that he didn't need to do anything since he was a guest, Kuro didn't know how to be idle. He was taking lessons from George, but his feet and hands couldn't yet handle it. So he ended up in the kitchen. Kuro learned that while taking care of so many others, Charlie and her dad left little time to take care of themselves. Their meals were quick, simple, and functional. The cooks failed to live up to their name. Kuro volunteered to fill the gap. Cooking was one of the few things Kuro was good at. He had made every meal he hadn't stolen when living with Phineas. Making the meals meant he could feel useful while everyone around him was working so hard. After being given free rein over the kitchen and open access to the pantry and cold cellar, he set about exploring the space. It was a trove of forgotten cookware. Everything beyond what was needed for simple meals for two had been pushed to the back of cupboards, or lost beneath piles of work gloves, boxes of nails, and other things that had no business being in a kitchen. Kuro scoured the rust off neglected pans and breathed life back to an oven that was storing a collection of kettles. Also, in a cupboard above the sink, which he had to stand on the counter to even reach, he found a true treasure. It was a simple wooden box, stained with spatters of grease and tomato sauce, and filled to bursting with scraps of paper. The papers were covered in writing, fading and smeared from age and use, but all following a familiar format, a list followed by a block of instructions. Recipes. They were just like alchemical recipes, full of precise times, measurements, and coded language that was shorthand for complex processes. If they could be deciphered and followed correctly, the magic they produced was delicious food. Kuro sorted through the recipes with care, as some had grown delicate with age. He compared the ingredients demanded by his newfound treasures against the contents of the pantries and formed a plan. The next day was solstice, and he had everything he needed to make a proper Yule feast, with ham, vegetables, breads, hot drinks, and the greatest and most perfect of all foods, pie. He lined up the kitchen chairs along the cupboards, where they acted as scaffolding that allowed him to reach the counter, and their backs served as a barricade against Ralph. He soon found that he also needed to barricade the doors and fend off invaders with shouting and wooden spoons, as both members of the Cook family had the same habit of eating things before they were ready and putting their fingers where they didn't belong. He started laying decoy ingredients out for them to steal so they wouldn't ruin the doughs and sauces he was preparing or abscond with any vegetables he couldn't replace. Kuro worked late into the evening, while his hosts rested and read. He went to bed reluctantly, worried about leaving his breads rising unsupervised and eager to wake up and get back to work. As he lay in the rarely used bed in a guest room under layers of heavy quilts he'd been given, he wondered at his own enthusiasm. It was a lot of work that he was doing, and he hadn't even been asked. He had convinced Charlie and her father to let him and chase them away whenever they offered to help. He could have been spending his vacation watching George eat salads and napping by the fire, but instead he was working himself to exhaustion and loving it. It was precisely because he didn't have to, he realized, that he was enjoying it. He couldn't think of another time in his life that he'd been allowed to choose what he was doing. Everything else had been out of necessity or obligation, or at the very least by someone else's design. Even the games he played were picked by others. He had chosen to cook, though. Also what to cook and how to cook it. It was delicious freedom. Kuro woke with the dawn excited to get back to work. He was met in the kitchen by Ralph, who cornered him and vigorously tasted his face. He was rescued by Mr. Cook, who was already returning from feeding the animals in the barn. "You're up early," he said. "Couldn't wait to open presents?" The thought hadn't crossed Kuro's mind. "The raisin buns need time to rise," explained Kuro. "And I wanted to try making hollandaise sauce." The farmer laughed. "You're gonna spoil us," he said, and nearly knocked Kuro over with a clap on the shoulder. "Well, I won't interfere with your art." Kuro opened the refrigerator to discover that he already had interfered. There were fingerprints in his dough, and some of the applesauce he'd prepared was missing. Kuro growled, and Mr. Cook retreated. He made steady progress until a cry shattered the quiet of the house. "Yule!" Charlie bellowed, announcing to the world that she was awake and that there would be no peace until that changed. She charged into the kitchen moments later, a woolly housecoat roughly tied over her pajamas and a toothbrush still in her mouth. "Presents!" she said. "Come open presents!" She grabbed Kuro and hauled him away from his simmering sauces. "No!" he cried. "It'll burn!" Charlie was faced with an insurmountable choice, having to wait to open gifts or eat a substandard breakfast. In an extremely Charlie fashion, she chose neither. She left and returned minutes later, dragging all of the gifts into the kitchen along with her father. Kuro only had a few things to open, which was a relief. The year before had been a bit too much for him, with many gifts from mysterious origins, none of which he'd reciprocated. This year was much simpler. A card from Marie that had been left in Charlie's care to deliver, and a wrapped package from both Charlie and her dad. They took turns opening things, which gave Kuro a chance to monitor the progress of breakfast. Charlie got a training sword and shield from her grandparents in Alfheim, who, while they had disowned their daughter for marrying a stray, were trying to claim Charlie back from that same stray and bring her into the family through bribery. Charlie got Kuro a heavy stone mortar and pestle, which he had found on the first day on the farm, but had been missing when he went looking for it to grind some pepper later.
"You're so good at alchemy, but the dumb professor doesn't even notice. And just think how good you could be if you had good stuff like the rich kids instead of using the old chip stuff they let us use for free. So I got you a good one so you could show everyone how good you really are."
Kuro was moved by how earnest Charlie was about it. She was truly upset that Kuro's skills were being ignored. Kuro didn't really want the attention of Professeur de Rigueur, but he appreciated the thoughtfulness. His other gift was just as wonderful. It was a hat. A warm, thick sheepskin hat with ear flaps and a fluffy lining. It was the sort of hat that Kuro had coveted when he was shivering in the streets in winter. It would keep him toasty warm while practicing magic with Bindle in the graveyard and on wintry walks to Danny's cabin. Charlie did not approve.
"Dad, that's so boring," she said. "Nobody wants clothes for solstice."
"Then you're gonna be really disappointed in your present, honey."
He grinned cruelly as he said it, and Charlie scowled in return.
I think it's great, said Kuro. But I didn't think to get you anything.
Oh, that's fine. Mr. Cook waved away the idea of a present, then took a long sniff. If breakfast is half as good as it smells, that's more than enough of a present for me.
We know you can't get us presents anyway, said Charlie. You don't have any money, and there isn't much of a way to get shopping done on Avalon.
I did get you a present, though, replied Kuro. Charlie slumped briefly in surprise, and then shuffled through the wrappings around her to uncover a small rectangular package.
It's a book! She said with excitement before even opening it.
A quick flurry of motion shredded Kuro's careful wrapping, exposing the novel beneath. Charlie's eyes nearly fell out of her head.
It's a Blandlands book! She squealed. I'm gonna read the whole thing today!
True to her word, she did nothing but read for the rest of the day. Following breakfast, she built herself a nest of blankets on the couch and became completely immobile. The book floated in front of her face, and the pages turned themselves. Kuro gave up on getting her to move and delivered lunch to her, most of which was stolen by Ralph, as she was too immersed in the book to defend it. That left Kuro free for the day to work on his beautiful creations. He sliced apples, rolled pastry, and ground spices in his new mortar. He even established a kind of truce with Ralph, who stopped attempting to gnaw on Kuro if given small samplings of the meats he was preparing. In the afternoon, he went to visit George and collect some eggs from the chickens for Nog. He spent a good half hour watching the massive tortoise take two bites of a cabbage. Before he was finished chewing, he retreated into his shell. It was fascinating to watch as his trunk-like legs and long neck pulled inside, and the hard ridges that looked like awnings closed over, making him an impregnable fortress. Moments later, Kuro heard a voice.
One should be careful about remembering to close the barn doors, it said.
It wasn't a human voice, nor was it quite using words. It was more like a collection of sensations, like claws scraping on gravel, and wind whipping through thick fur in the shape of words that skipped his ears and went straight to his brain. Kuro whipped around, alert and ready to bolt, but the voice in his head had no direction, so Kuro didn't know which way to run until he felt the eyes on him. He turned to see a silhouetted canine form padding its way through the door that Kuro had failed to latch behind him. At first, he thought it was Ralph, but it wasn't as fluffy. Then he had a moment of horror as he thought it might be Garmer, Dubois' familiar, but it wasn't big enough. It was longer and leaner, with a pointed nose and ears, and a look of cunning rather than the cold confidence of a wolf.
A coyote might sneak in and steal a chicken, the creature continued.
Kuro moved to put himself between the beast and the chickens, although he didn't know what he'd do if attacked. The two of them were closely matched in size, and Kuro lacked the mouthful of sharp teeth that the coyote had.
Worry not, Kuro Hayashi. I've not come for any chickens today.
The words carried with them more meaning than if they had been voiced. Chicken was laden with hunger, and there was a clear emphasis on the word today. Two words that stuck out in the uncomforting assurance, though, did not carry any meaning. They were bland and flat, like a blank gray space in an otherwise ornate tapestry.
How do you know my name? Kuro asked.
I have heard it said, replied the coyote. You are a creature of some conversation in the wildlands.
He said wildlands as though it were the punchline to a joke. Kuro felt at quite a disadvantage. The creature seemed to know a fair bit about him, and Kuro didn't even know what he was talking to.
I'm sorry, he said, trying not to offend the chatty predator. Who are you?
Apologies, I've not introduced myself. How rude.
The beast bowed its head courteously.
I forget sometimes how much people love their names. Those like me do not rely on such things. We have a voice and a scent. True things that cannot be changed or hidden. Names are costumes, disguises, and lies. No different than the clothes you wear. Wouldn't you agree, Kuro Hayashi?
Again, Kuro's name, flat and uninteresting. A plain printed label covering up the thing it was meant to identify.
I suppose so.
It was hard to argue with the coyote, but Kuro couldn't help but notice that he had failed to explain who he was in any way. Rather than press the issue, he asked, Why are you here?
I have come to see you, of course, Kuro Hayashi.
The coyote performed a parody of a bow.
Much has been said about you, but very little has been said to you. Most are too bound by promises and propriety to come themselves and are happy to partake in gossip. I found myself bored of rumor and having a gap in my schedule, so I decided to pay you a visit, to smell for myself whether what they say is true. Do forgive my rudeness of appearing unannounced, but I doubted I could secure an invitation. We coyotes are rarely welcome guests.
Why is that? Kuro asked.
The coyote chuckled. We are thieves, sneaks, and liars. We're villains. Just ask anyone. He gave a sly, vicious grin.
Are you really?
Said Kuro. He didn't have much trust in the opinion of anyone. That earned a genuine laugh and a wagging tail from the coyote. You would ask a liar for their truth? What a strange child. Perhaps it is fair to say that when everyone has already decided who and what you are, one can choose to either accept that role or spend their entire life fighting against it. One of those is a lot of work and prone to failure. Though I don't need to tell you that, do I, Master Thief Kuro Hayashi?
The coyote was brutally correct, and it succeeded in making Kuro change the subject.
What did you want to know?
Whether what they say is true, of course.
The coyote gave a sly grin, though with the slant of his eyes and the angle of his mouth, he couldn't likely produce any other kind.
Would you like to know what they say?
Kuro didn't expect that he did, but the coyote didn't wait for an answer.
Words amongst the fairy folk is that you are an impossible child, a motherless son, and a Luton wizard. They say that you were found and raised by the Path of the Lost, and are the beloved of the West Wind.
That's mostly sort of true,
said Kuro.
That's my favorite kind of true, replied the coyote, settling on its haunches and preparing to listen.
Some wizards made me out of Luton and human parts. I don't really know how that worked, but I don't think I have a mom. I grew up mostly in Detritus Lane. That's what you mean by the Path of the Lost, right? I don't think it raised me, though. It's just a street.
The coyote perked its ears and cocked its head.
Is it? Good to know, he said mockingly.
Everything the coyote said dripped with layers of implied meaning and innuendo that Kuro couldn't start to unravel. He felt like the beast was playing a careful game of verbal chess and Kuro was throwing dice in a game he didn't know the rules to.
I don't even know what you mean about the wind, though.
Don't you? The coyote replied in mock surprise. Does she not cling to you, caress you, carry you, and guard you jealously? Is that not her scent I smell on you?
Do you mean my magic? Asked Kuro. That's just magic. The wind doesn't have feelings. It's not a person.
I suppose the wizards told you so, said the coyote. I'm sure they're correct. They know so many things. Then, of course, I'm not a person either.
That raised a very big question for Kuro.
What are you, actually?
Kuro asked, and then added quickly,
Sorry, is that okay to ask?
Whatever do you mean?
The creature said, pretending not to understand.
You're not an ordinary coyote,
said Kuro.
Most coyotes don't talk.
Ah, you suspect me of being something more than a mere animal on the prowl for unattended poultry?
Again, a sly grin and a slow wag of the tail.
An excellent question. It could be that I am a changeling in a strange disguise, or a wizard's familiar left too long unattended and begun to think for itself. Or it may be that I am an ordinary coyote who has learned how to converse with people. Does that seem any less likely than a human who can pass through the veil and steal the magic of the Fae? Perhaps I know even less about what I am than you do yourself. What I can tell you is that there are many things in the wildlands unknown to wizard kind. Unlike some, I am exactly what I appear to be, and there are many stranger things in the world than I.
At that moment, Kuro was startled by a deep but gentle thumping noise from behind him. he looked to see that George had extended his legs and was slowly stepping his way to the corner of the barn.
"For example," said the coyote, pointing his nose in the direction of the tortoise, "did you know that our mutual friend over there can see the future? I suspect that his vigorous escape is signaling that I have overstayed my welcome."
Seconds later, Ralph burst through the door. He began barking loudly and chased the coyote around the barn, panicking the animals and stirring up dust and hay. Crow lunged for the dog, putting his arms around his neck and his shoulder against his chest in a hopeless effort to keep the beast back.
"You should probably run," said Kuro. "I can't really hold him."
As the coyote pranced, laughing, out the door, he said,
"It was a pleasure to meet you, beloved of the wind. You are what I was expecting, but not at all who I was expecting."
Kuro let Ralph drag him along for a while, acting as an anchor to slow the dog down. He wasn't certain whether he was protecting the coyote or Ralph. He expected a fight between them would go poorly for both, so keeping the two apart seemed like a good plan. Kuro was troubled by the strange things the coyote had said to him, mostly by the overwhelming feeling that it was all true and that he didn't really understand any of it. He let his dinner preparations soothe his unease, though whenever the door to the house opened and a breeze would encircle him as it passed through the kitchen, Kuro wondered whether he understood anything about magic at all. Dinner was a triumph. Kuro didn't know if eating it himself or hearing the excessive praise from Charlie and her dad was the better part of the meal. He briefly imagined a world where he could just stay on the farm and cook every day instead of going back to school. The true glory of the evening was Kuro's pie. It was apple, with a sweet crumble and a caramel drizzle on top. Waiting for it had been torture, and giving parts of it away was a feat of grace he wasn't certain he could repeat. It wasn't just delicious. It was also familiar and comforting, like a hug so warm and tight that it made his ribs ache. The reaction to it was not quite what Kuro had expected. Charlie devoured it without a word and gleefully returned for seconds. Her father, though, ate it slowly and had to frequently stop to take deep breaths and to wipe his eyes and nose as though it were very spicy. Despite that, he kept saying, "That's a good pie. That's a real good pie." When he'd finally finished his piece and recovered from it, he asked, "Where did you learn to make pie like that?"
"I found a recipe in the cupboard," said Kuro. "I could tell it was a good one because it was the most faded and stained."
"Yeah, that makes sense." Mr. Cook nodded and swallowed a couple of times. "That was a really good pie. Thanks, Kuro. That was good." He then pushed himself from the table and went outside to chop some wood.
"That was weird," said Charlie as she considered the merits of a third slice.
"You thought so too?" said Kuro.
"Totally. That was a really good pie, but not like a burst into tears kind of good pie."
Kuro looked at his treasure box of recipes on the counter and thought that he understood. Those weren't just recipes. They were family recipes. Helena's family recipes. The pie had felt familiar to him because he'd eaten it before. It was a recipe Charlie's mother had known well enough to bake by heart when she was being forced to take care of him. He had just unknowingly recreated a favorite of Mr. Cook's murdered wife. When he explained that to Charlie and asked if she thought he had done something wrong, she responded by taking her third slice and eating it slowly, quietly savoring it, something he wasn't sure he'd ever seen her do before.
Thank you for listening to Stealing from Wizards. If you liked our show, please consider rating or reviewing on iTunes. If you want to support this podcast or just can't wait for the next chapter, the full book is available on Amazon, Kobo, and Indigo. Our theme music was written by Camille Saint-Saëns, transcribed by Franz Liszt, performed by Rebecca Verdun, and used with permission. This episode was produced by Jim Tigwell.